Welcome to the 69th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
I'm Toby Chad.
And as England sack Peter Moores for the second time, welcome to the podcast that's not planning a change in its lineup before the Ashes.
We've got all kinds of fun lined up this episode for you. We're going to be reviewing, as ever, what's made us happy and what's made us sad in the cricketing world over the last fortnight. I'm going to be talking about a few musical cricketers. We're going to be reviewing the wonderful book, The Promise of Endless Summer. And we've got an interview with the Australian podcaster and blogger, Dennis Friedman. But before all that, Andy, you have got something that you are dying to tell the world about.
So I'm the kind of batsman for whom scoring 20-odd always feels like a pretty good day's work. In fact, I'm the kind of batsman that once I'm off naught, I sort of tend to relax. You're like, God, duck successfully avoided.
My day's work is done. I'm exactly the same.
Yeah, exactly. I can go back to the pavilion with a smile on my face. And, you know, anything more than 20-odd feels like a triumph. Now, in the last few seasons, I've developed this wonderful skill at getting myself into the 40s and then getting out in a very sort of awful way, you know, kind of stumped dancing down the wicket to a useless spinner, this kind of thing. So the other week, I'd got to 48, and my teammates made, I think, the very good decision not to tell me on the basis that they thought this might inspire another act of madness. So I looked at the pavilion in genuine bewilderment when I heard the cheers and looked over to see everyone standing up. And it is quite nice to score a 50 by surprise. And I was able, you know, lifted my bat to the pavilion, and it really does make you feel like a proper cricketer. But of course, you try to do it with a bit of nonchalance. You don't want to look as if you're overwhelmed by the occasion.
No, I have to say the only 50 that I've ever scored was in school cricket, actually. And I can't remember it very clearly. I think I was about 14. But what I do remember doing was raising my bat to all four corners of the ground, even though three of those corners were occupied by nothing but trees. Did you do that? Because I think that is the moment when you really feel like you've got it, when you acknowledge the whole stadium around you.
Do you know what? I didn't do that. I kind of wish I had, because I should have milked the moment more than I did. I think actually, on the basis that I'll never score 100, I should have taken my helmet off. But I did give the bat a good solid wave.
Kissed the badge on your helmet.
There is a bit of a sort of entertaining subtext to the story, in that after 20 overs of this game, I'd opened the batting, which I rarely do, and I was on 11 runs after 20 overs a very, very slow, literally muddy pitch. And my captain, and this is the most wonderfully English way of putting things, he said, Andy, what's your plan? Which was an incredibly English way of saying, oh my God, score some runs or get out. Which I did very much appreciate. But yes, the joys of village cricket, and my season will be downhill from there.
Unfortunately, of course, the season's ended here in Australia. We're now plunging into the depths of winter, which means that occasionally the temperature gets down into the low 20s. But what it does mean is that I've been able to turn my attention, obviously, back to English cricket. And one of the things that I've been quite pleased to see, actually, is the number of decent international players who have been coming across to English counties for the 2020 matches in particular. Over the last couple of weeks, South African paceman Wayne Parnell has signed for Glamorgan, joining Jack Rudolph and Conan Ingram there. Hamish Rutherford has come across to Derbyshire, admittedly as cover for Tillakratni Dilshan, but Hashim Amla is already there at Derbyshire. And I promise this isn't a kind of political jibe, given given that the political turns that have happened in the UK over the last week. But I do think it's a wonderful thing that suddenly there's a possibility of England becoming a bit more of a sort of 2020 world hub, which I think is important both in terms of having a really thriving cricketing community in the UK, but also in kind of balancing out the centre of power that really the Indian leagues have obviously become for 2020 as well.
I think we often do county cricket down. I think it's this very instinctive English thing. You know, I get very irritated. Every April, you will rely on the sports pages of several papers. They will proudly publish this picture of Glamorgan with one man and his dog watching and say, oh, isn't county cricket dead? And, you know, I recently popped into the Oval recently and found myself watching Sangakkara opening the batting with Rory Burns, is a young prospect at Surrey. And for me, that's the perfect example of what I think you're talking about. You know, you've got a young English talent coming through, but getting to play with one of the greatest batsmen of all time. And I mean, that's what it should be about.
you raise an interesting point. You say you pops into the Oval. Are there lots of people who are popping into the Oval at the moment?
So I've been introduced to this phenomenon by one of my teammates, which is the joy of after-work cricket, which is something I've never really done before. But I'm blessed enough to work close enough to the Oval that if I can sort of slip away on a quiet day relatively promptly, I can get a good sort of 20 overs worth. And as I said, I stumbled upon Sangakkara, I saw Peterson batting as well that evening, Monty Panesar bowling, and very reasonably, you know, in the, all these debates, and very justified debates in the context of high test match tickets, it's free entry at the Oval after tea, which is very, I think, very generous, hard to argue with.
And I think,
it just supports your point about, you know, it's wonderful to see these players coming in.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. Talking of things that are wonderful to see, I'm going to put it out there, and I have to say that I have a complete lack of ability to see the regime change at the ECB as a dawn of new hope. Actually, I think the way that Peter Moores was got rid of, hearing it from the press before you heard it from the powers that be, is sort of signals the fact that there is really no sort of strong leadership within the organisation. Am I being really pessimistic?
I don't think you're being pessimistic at all. I think I'm in the weird position where I didn't want Peter Moores to get the job the second time, but I think having given it to him, not only have they got rid of him in a very borderline cruel way, actually, but I don't think they've really given him the time to show what he could or couldn't do. I mean, my personal feeling is, yes, the World Cup was a shambles. I struggle to pin that on the coach, really. I mean,
I agree.
This England ODI team has been a shambles for a while. I think if you thought Peter Moores was the right job for, you know, a year ago, he was the right man a year ago, I would have stuck by him for the Ashes series, and I think they've treated him extremely poorly all round. He seems like a decent man who's been somewhat over-promoted. And let's hope that Strauss tries to get a grip on things. Do you think Cook's safe, given that Downton and Moores were his two great defenders and they're both gone?
Well, it's difficult to say, isn't it? And often when these things go two ways. When they get rid of a coach, they want to keep some kind of stability and continuity even. And so they want to keep on the captain. Or they just think, well, look, we are getting rid of the old structure. We might as well get rid of it in its entirety. But, you know, maybe Strauss and Cook together as director, English cricket, and captain, English cricket, as the ridiculous title of Andrew Strauss now goes. Maybe actually they'll be able to, in that formation, relive some of the glory days when they opened the batting together. We can but hope.
From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to be telling us about some interesting moments when the worlds of music and cricket collided.
So we all know that occasionally cricketers can sort of think that they're rock stars, really. There are some interesting YouTube moments of Brett Lee doing his Bollywood impressions. Mark Butcher was quite well renowned as a guitarist and songmaking, including poignantly at the funeral of his England teammate Ben Holyoake. Graham Swan was just as much a centre of attention off the field with a microphone in hand as he was on the pitch. And then actually researching this, I came across quite a lot of other interesting, in inverted commas, cricketers trying to think that they could be musicians as well, including a particularly interesting video, which I know caught your eye, Andy, of Dwayne Bravo. Tell us all about it.
I was reading your notes for the episode, and you mentioned this Dwayne Bravo as a musician, and I thought this is too good to be true, and I googled it, and I found myself listening to Yenda, featuring Gana Bala, Naveen Madhav, Sajin Madhav, and Dwayne Bravo. And I very patiently watched this video, and I thought, God, 3 minutes in, I haven't seen any Dwayne Bravo. I've really been shortchanged here. And then lo and behold, the music changes to something like a kind of Western, you know, when the bad cowboy comes through the door. And Dwayne Bravo enters the stage. He is in a fluorescent pink shirt, and he's the only person in the video not wearing jeans. He's wearing a sort of golden dress. And he begins, I think it could be loosely termed as singing, and he's very much centre stage. But this is the sort of unintended consequence of the IPL, isn't it? West Indian all-rounders getting involved in Indian music.
Okay, so let's leave Dwayne Bravo as a kind of cameo walk-on role for this from the archives, because actually what I want to focus on is not the cricketers who sort of let their hair down by becoming musicians, but actually cricketers who had a kind of more entwined relationship with music. And actually, this was all inspired by the book that we're going to be reviewing in a minute, which is The Promise of Endless Summers, a collection of cricketing obituaries from the Daily Telegraph. And in that, there's an obituary of a guy called Frank Parr, who I had heard of briefly in the past, but I never knew that much about him. And he was a wicketkeeper for Lancashire in the 1950s. And he was good enough to, at one point, be talked about for selection for England. But he wasn't the sort of character that the England setup wanted at that stage. And Brian Statham memorably described him as, quotes, an arty, untidy type who looked what he was, a spare time musician, which is a bit of a slap down, really. And for Parr, the lives of a jazz trombonist, and he was a very fine jazz trombonist, and professional cricketer were never really going to be compatible.
Now, when Statham made that comment, did it indicate that at this time in the 1950s, in terms of status, a cricketer would have been seen as a much more reputable profession than a musician? Or was that just Statham's view? How would it, you know, if you were wanting to make a success of yourself, which would have been seen as the more esteemed profession at that time?
Well, I suppose it depends who you talk to, really, like it would at any point. But I think the thing about Parr was that he was a trombonist, and the type of jazz he played was very much going back to the kind of big band swing era of the 20s and 30s, and it became very popular again in the 50s and 60s. He played for a band called the Mick Mulligan Band, and he wasn't the most straight down the line jazz musician, let's just say. I mean, there are stories of him being so drunk that he would just go on stage and be completely unable to make any noise other than a kind of loud farting noise down his trombone. And I think that probably is what Statham was referring to, in the sense that he was a bit of a bohemian scale of musicians, certainly. Whereas obviously, you know, the life of an England cricketer was a professional, of course, rather than an amateur. The life of an England cricketer obviously came with a lot more glitz. And the sad thing about this story is that, kind of, if you ask whether the cricketing or the jazz world would have achieved more notoriety, well, he didn't actually achieve notoriety really in either. And through trying to sort of achieve both, he achieved neither in the end, which I suppose is sort of the sadness when you sometimes try to have a dual career in that regard. The other person who sprung to mind, and actually, you know, I've been thinking a lot about cricket and music over the last couple of weeks. The other reason being that I work for a record label here in Australia, and I found an album put out by the label I now work for a few years ago, which indicates the link between cricket and music for someone for whom, cricketing success came pretty brightly, let's say, and that is, of course, Don Bradman. And the Don was a prodigiously gifted pianist and a great lover of classical music. And he also was a composer, and he wrote a piece called Every Day is a Rainbow Day for Me.
This was celebrating one of his beginnings, was it? He got home and said,
"Well,
this is a rainbow day."
It's kind of typical of that kind of. I think it was written just after the Second World War, and I think it's typical of that kind of sentimentality that you get in a lot of music. Then I wouldn't suggest that you rush out and listen to it, I have to say.
Would you say that there are clear crossover skills between the art of batting and, say, something like the skill of being very good at playing the piano?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because actually one of the things that's quite distinctive to the piano as opposed to any other instrument, and something that you really need to get very, very good at it, is an ability to lock yourself in a room with a keyboard by yourself for hours and hours and hours on end and practice technical things over and over and over again. And one of the things, of course, that we know about Don Bradman as a batsman was that he became so successful precisely because he was technically so strong and because he was actually technically so repetitive. He wasn't scared about boring the world with just, you know, doing the same thing over and over again. He wasn't someone who was, you know, just a natural stroke maker. He was no Keith Miller. And actually, I suspect that that's probably, you know, they're probably very similar skills, that ability to be very insular and just practice something time and time again.
I think it's a fascinating comparison, actually, because when they talk about Bradman, they often talk about him as a child just obsessively sitting there and hitting, isn't it, the idea
he practiced with the golf ball with the stump. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, yeah. And so I guess that sort of obsessive practice of technical detail, yeah, I can certainly see that.
And then the other thing about Don Bradman is that his musical genes have carried on. His granddaughter, Greta Bradman, actually announced that she was recording a new album with Decca last week, which is called My Hero, and is dedicated in part to Don Bradman. And for her, she must be the only person who exists in the world for whom Don Bradman is not, as you know, is not a hero because of his cricketing prowess, but is a hero because of his LP collection. Now the last thing, just the last interesting cricketing musical connection that I've sort of stumbled across over the last couple of weeks was actually connected to Queen Elizabeth II. And it's not because she's a cricketer, at least I didn't know that she is. She always looks bored when she gets sort of trotted out to be presented to the teams at Lord's. And I have no idea whether she's musical or not. But on the occasion of her 60th birthday in 1986, her youngest son, Prince Edward, commissioned Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, who were by that point, you know, household names after the success of Evita, to write a musical based on cricket. Now, I was reading the synopsis of this musical earlier, and basically it's completely impenetrable. It's set, you know, during a cricket match, and a guy's batting and his wife is jealous that he spends so much time playing cricket, and she runs off with someone else, and then he gets hit in the head by a bouncer, but he recovers and then he hits the winning runs, and then they all get back together, and then it's all happiness and light. So I'm not sure it's going to be the most engaging piece of music anyway, but I just thought it was very, very interesting that suddenly for this kind of moment of state ceremony, our dear Queen's 60th birthday, what should come out but a musical about cricket. The Review. And for this episode, we've been reading The Promise of Endless Summer, Cricket Lives from the Daily Telegraph. And this book does exactly what it says on the tin, really. It's a collection of obituaries that have been published in the Daily Telegraph over a period of many decades, all the way through from Don Bradman to Hanzi Cronje, really. And not just cricketers, commentators as well. Christopher Martin Jenkins, for instance, is in here. How did you read this book? Did you read it from cover to cover, or did you dot around in it?
So I started off with the intent of reading it to cover to cover, but I think inevitably you find yourself dotting around because there are names you want to go for. And I think this is a book that really is designed. You know, we talked last episode about how the joy of wisdom is browsing. I think the joy of this book is browsing, really, sort of skipping from cricketer to cricketer. It reminded me how much I love reading obituaries. If that doesn't sound like a really morbid thing, I find myself often now...
It sounds slightly morbid, but I now know your point, having read this book.
The thing is, I often find now when I pick up my copy of The Economist that often the first thing I go to is the obituary, because there's a real skill in encapsulating a life, a mini biography, in just a couple of pages. You have to make everything so succinct, and you have to really pick the right things out.
And I think one of the, just going back to what you were saying earlier about going through and looking for the obituaries that you really wanted to read, one of the things that pleasantly surprised me about this book, maybe it shouldn't have been a surprise, is that there are a fair few people whose obituaries are included of whom I had never heard before. And there was a real sense of discovery I found throughout the book. So, for instance, there was this Hopper Reed, he's called, England's fastest bowler in 1935, and it talks about his magic for Essex and for England. And then it just ends with the wonderful line. He goes off and he tours with the MCC to Australia and New Zealand, and then the last line of the obituary is, "But on returning home, he pursued his profession as an accountant, full stop." End of the obituary. And I sort of learned a lot, actually, of new things from reading this.
Well, I think it's that difference. You've got those people you know a lot about, for whom you often retread some familiar material and then learn that bit new. And as you say, there are those people who you completely discover. I think we're all, as cricket fans, there's an obsession with statistics. And I think what the obituaries show here is there's a lot to be said for a well-picked stat. Because sometimes when you just list a lot of batting averages made this, it doesn't tell you that much. But then this really struck home, there's a lovely bit on Keith Andrew, a fantastic Northants wicketkeeper. And the obituary concludes by talking about how he once went through a period of over 40 hours in the field, some 900 overs, without conceding a bye. And I thought, actually, that's a killer stat, isn't it? That really gives you a sort of sense of the player. And I think that was definitely something I learned from this.
The stat question is an interesting one, because constantly throughout this book, as you were saying earlier, you're constantly thinking about what is it that makes a good obituary. So that kind of, and how you paint a picture of someone's life. Often, you know, many of these are very short. They're only, you know, a page and a half to 2 pages long, a lot of these. What else do you think came across as being, you know, key to the art of summing up someone's life?
So again, I think there's the art of picking a good anecdote, because if you've got a whole biography on someone, you know, you list them all, don't you? You can just come out with the sort of entire selection of stories about them. And I think there's a wonderful, the John Arlott obituary starts with the fact that he ended his career as a radio cricket commentator with the words, "And after Trevor Bailey, it will be Christopher Martin Jenkins." And what a wonderful way of summing up the understated, modest professionalism of a man in a single line. I think the one other thing I would say in terms of the skill of a good obituary, it's very easy, like all sports writers do, to sort of talk in cliche. And we can talk about a great batsman, we can talk about them piling up the runs. The really good obituaries are where they pick out what was it specifically about that way that that person played the game. And the example I picked out, Dennis Brooks, funnily enough, another Northants cricketer, this line: "Brooks scorned brute force, gathering runs almost imperceptibly with elegant drives and subtle deflections." I never saw, you know, Brooks play, obviously. In that line, I've got a sense of the type of batsman he was, and yeah. There's a real genius to that.
I think the other thing that's interesting when you look through the sort of variety of obituaries here is the perspective of the writer, because there are quite a lot of obituaries that don't actually have a name put to them. They are presumably just someone who's on the editorial team at the Telegraph, you know, when and they come into the office in the morning and are told they need to write to obituary of whoever. But then there are a fair few as well who are written by quite interesting people. One of them that I think is quite interesting is the obituary of the batsman Arthur Milton, which is written by his opening partner David Green. And basically he doesn't talk about, you know, he doesn't talk about his life from when he was a young boy to when he was an old man. He talks simply about what it was like to open the batting with him. And simply from that perspective, you're able to actually learn a lot, both about the man technically and about the man as a man as well. And then the other thing that I know you've picked up on is when you actually have personal friends who are reviewing books as well, reviewing lives.
So perhaps the most moving obituary in the book was that of David Bairstow, written by his friend Michael Parkinson. Bairstow, who committed suicide, and this it was written so personally, and finishes with the very moving lines: "When I was told he had committed suicide, I said, 'Don't be daft, not bluey, not that strong, fearless, laughing mate I knew. Now all I can think is, why, old lad, why?'" And this is so much more than a summary of a life. I mean, it is a really pained description of a friend trying to come to terms with a really difficult end.
So that's The Promise of Endless Summer, Cricket Lives from the Daily Telegraph. I think it's fair to say that it's a book that both of us will keep and will keep dipping back into as the years go by. So to the interview, and for this episode we have got Dennis Friedman, author of the Dennis Does Cricket blog here in Australia, and host of Australia's most popular cricket podcast, Can't Bowl, Can't Throw. Now, I read that it's Australia's most popular cricket podcast. Is that true, or is that a marketing claim?
I'm going to have to say it's probably true, but you guys might want to debate it.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, no, I'm not gonna stand up against it. It's a brilliant achievement. And welcome to Reverse Sweat Radio. One of the things that I think I really enjoy about your writing, particularly on your blog, is the way that you sort of champion particular causes, particularly after they've sort of slipped out of the mainstream media. And one of the things that I've enjoyed reading about, particularly on your blog and some of the interviews as well that you've been doing on your podcast, is the whole South African quota debacle that kicked up around the World Cup semi-final. Can you just talk a little bit about why, for you, this is such an important issue?
Yeah, interesting question, Toby. Look, I probably first became aware of the whole quota issue 6 to 9 months ago. Fidosa Munda, who's a Crick Info correspondent from South Africa, slipped in a nice piece about how provincial teams in South Africa had to increase their quota of black and coloured players from 4 to 6 on their squads. And this happened 6 or 9 months ago. And at the time, I wrote a piece called White Non-South African View on Cricket, on quotas in South, on cricket quotas. And it got quite a, quite a lot of hits, especially in South Africa, I guess. And it just sparked my interest because I guess Australia has its own battles with racism and
xenophobia,
and has for some time. You know, you go right back to 1788 when the real Captain Cook landed here.
Yes, the other Captain Cook. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the one that got to Fiji and then got to ended his life there. But, you know, you go back right there and Australia's had a pretty horrendous track record of managing or working with the Indigenous population here. And then, you know, right up until the mid-70s, early 80s, you had the White Australia policy. You've had the Cronulla riots a few years ago on Australia Day. There's Pauline Hanson. It goes on and on. And Australia's probably no different to most other countries in terms of multiculturalism's a wonderful thing to strive for, but we've probably got a long way to go. But anyhow, it's the first time that I'd seen it sort of filter into a sport that I enjoyed, you know.
Yeah.
In AFL, if I compare it with AFL, the Australian Football League's done a very good job of educating for maybe 15 or 20 years back to the Nicky Winmar scenario when he was at Victoria Park. And you might not remember this, Toby, but there was an Aboriginal player in the 80s who was getting racially abused out in Collingwood, and he lifted up his guernsey and just pointed to his skin, and that sort of a guy called Wayne Ludby took that photo, and that's kind of iconic.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say it became a sort of iconic moment, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, and you know, it's the Australian version of those guys at the Olympics. You know, those black runners holding up their fist on the podium at the Olympics. I can't remember their names now, but anyhow, so sport and using races or prejudice as a way to choose or pick players, to me, it's just something that doesn't seem right, doesn't fit right. And so I started exploring a bit further, and so I wrote my piece. I then had we then had the World Cup semi-final where it came out that someone in cricket, South Africa, mostly Haroon Lorgaard, had told Russell Domingo, who was the team manager, to include another player of colour in the semi-final, and Kyle Abbott was dropped for Vernon Philander, and Vernon Philander was nowhere near ready to play in that match. And Abbott was on fire, and as it turned out, you know, the bowling there might have cost him that semi-final, and then it just got a bit silly because you know, there was rumours that AB de Villiers was actually going, and some others were going to stand out of that match in protest before when all this happened. Mike Horn, who was their high performance coach, came out and said, look, the biggest challenge for him was trying to get the players up 2 or 3 days before the match after that sort of selection had happened because they were all down about it and just thought it was unfair. You now have Vernon Philander, who's probably could be labelled a quota player, which is unfair.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of unfair. No one comes well out of that situation, do they, really?
And Haroon Lorgaard then had a crack at Mike Horn and said he doesn't have a good command of English, which I just think's hilarious, and sort of had denied everything.
Yeah.
Then came out and said, actually, no, we have an unofficial... I think the way he worded it was, everyone's picked on merit, but we have an eye to the transformation process. And I was having a debate with Fidusa Munda the other day, And I just think those two things are diametrically opposed. I don't know, you can pick someone based on performance, but then also pick someone based on race. You pick one or the other.
Yeah.
And then the worst thing about the whole thing, mate, is that it's not a formal policy. And so it's all sort of secretive and embarrassing for them. And, you know, the repercussions are quite big, I think, because the ICC's charter states that government interference is a reason to ban or suspend ICC members. And
well, hence why Sri Lanka have been in such trouble recently, yeah.
So Sri Lanka's just been threatened with it, and they've got funds being held at the moment from the World Cup by the ICC. And to me, in my eyes, this is no different. In fact, it's probably worse. So that's sort of, you know, that probably tells the story of my interest, and I guess hopefully that sums up the issue at the moment. It's not going to go away. 80% of South Africa is black. The ANC are the ruling party in South Africa, and politics plays a big part over there. And this is quite a populist type policy. You know, there's still a lot of angst and hurt, and it's quite an emotive topic, and so it should be.
Well, yeah, and I suppose the one of the interesting things about the topic is it's actually in a way quite difficult to talk about. South Africans, you know, I know that there's a lot of acrimony within South Africa in terms of talking about it. And, you know, people get, you know, whichever side of the fence you sit on, you kind of get labeled a branded a racist for whatever your view is. And similarly, you know, the some of the mainstream publications seem to have sort of, you know, they sort of report on the facts, but they go a bit quiet on the sort of the opinion part. Where do you sort of feel, because you are, I mean, I think it's fair to say, quite an opinionated writer and quite an opinionated pundit, as it were. And you are, you know, you have a significant audience through your blog and through your podcast. There must be a kind of bit of a sense of responsibility there in terms of your really sort of championing this issue and indeed the absurdity of it.
Look, Toby, with this issue, I've tried to be extremely balanced. So we had, I also did a podcast with a guy called Ben Karpinski, who's quite a learned sports commentator in South Africa.
Yeah, I heard that one. It's a great podcast, yeah.
And he came out in that podcast and said, look, I'm probably stupid for having this chat with you, Dennis, because I'm going to be racist and so forth. But essentially he said, look, if the South African's political system says we need quotas, then let's just codify it and get on with it. The problem is that it's swept under the carpet. It's not swept under the carpet, sorry. It's a hidden thing. It's like the secret handshake of South African sporting politics. And that's what's causing the angst, because now you've got Lorgaard tripping himself up, you've got Mike Horn tripping himself up, you've got AB de Villiers wanting to not play. You've got Alan Donald quit as the head bowling coach, and people closer to it than I am over there who are well-respected are telling me it's because of the quota system.
So right, yeah.
Where does it end? I don't know. And, you know, again, I've tried to be quite balanced with this one and show both sides. My personal view is I don't believe race and sport mix at all. And if I take the Australian example, all the money and all the education for 20 years has been spent down at grassroots, and that creates the opportunities as people come through and become adults to then make their own decision and fight at an adult basis with equal opportunity. And I think starting top down is the wrong way.
And it's a topic that we could talk about for hours. And it's, you know, one thing that's quite interesting about it to me is the fact that, you know, when apartheid ended, well, you know, going all the way back to Basil D'Oliveira, you know, these issues have been around for ages, and yet there still is kind of no real kind of consensus and no real forum to sort of officially debate it properly. It is still sort of slightly, as you say, not swept under the carpet, but done, you know, in a pretty secretive way, in a sense. But moving on from a serious issue to an issue that you've been laughing about quite a lot recently on your various channels, the fortunes of the English cricket team.
No,
it's not. And I have to say, when I'm not crying, I'm laughing too. So, but one of the, you know, you were quite outspoken around what, you know, when James Anderson reached his 100th test, about questioning, you know, was he as great a bowler as everyone thought? Alistair Cook, I love on your blog the Alistair Cook time since his last century. You know, Peter Moores has come under your fire, Jonathan Trott as well. Do you think there's any hope of it being a decent Ashes series this English summer?
Look, I'm struggling to, you know, objectively, I'm struggling to come up with an argument to sort of support that claim. I think England's got some decent batting. You know, I think the middle order, I think Balance, Bell, Root can all bat. I think you'll get a cameo or two from Butler, and you might or might not get one from Owen Ali. I think the opening spots are a problem, right? So they'll put some runs on the board now and then. But the bowling is just a shambles. And you need to take 20 wickets to win test matches. And if you look what's going on in the West Indies at the moment, they had 120 overs to bowl at the West Indies in the first test and couldn't do it. And it was essentially the second new ball that saved them in this second test. So they had to get to the 81st over before something would happen.
And sort of historically, England's sort of strength in ambushing Australia in England has been around sort of the swinging ball going to Headingley and being able to sort of bamboozle the Australian batsmen. But as you say, you do wonder whether England have the firepower there in terms of the bowlers.
So I think that's where the gap's going to be, because I think the Australian batting is same or if not maybe slightly better than the English. I think the opening positions strengthen it up for Australia, but the bowling attack will just run riot. You're going to have Mitch Johnson and Harris with the new ball. Mitch Stark may not play, but if he plays, look out if he gets that Yorker going.
Yeah, totally.
Josh Hazelwood's over there. And people forget Peter Siddle's going over there as well, who averages and strikes just as well as James Anderson does in English conditions. So, and then you've got the two spinners. This is an interesting thing. The last Ashes in England, I think, was a Graham Swan Ashes.
Yep.
And he was the guy that won England the Ashes more than anyone else. But there is no spinner there anymore. There's a part-timer in Moeen Ali. Whereas Australia's taking over.
There's Joe Root. Come on.
So it's like you're playing part-timers, whereas Australia's taking over the guys that finished number one and number two on the Shield wicket table this year, which is Nathan Lyon and Fawad Ahmed. Now, Fawad Ahmed's an interesting one. He could be the guy from left field who really turns this thing on its head if he gets enough tests. But anyhow, I just can't see England matching Australia anywhere. Maybe Butler matches Haddon, and that's about as far as it goes.
Well, and it's interesting because it's kind of a clash of cricket and cultures in a way, because Australia, who have really sort of said, we don't really care how old you are, if you're performing now, taking wickets now, making runs now, you're going to play in the team now. And in England, who go for this kind of hyper-developmental approach to things, and so people who really aren't, you know, are sort of slightly bits and pieces players and aren't really sort of on, you know, they won't necessarily play the best English spinner playing in the world at the moment, simply because they'll be thinking, well, what are we going to do in the 2027 World Cup?
The interesting thing, Toby, is, you know, KP's probably not going to play because he's one of the reasons is he's too old now. Let's move on. But there's five players in that Australian squad who are KP's age or older.
Yeah, yeah.
So why is age a barrier? Why is it any different to race? You're either performing or you're not, you know?
Yeah, well, exactly. So your prediction, scoreline?
I think the rain's going to be a major factor.
Yep.
let's assume we get some dry weather. I'd be surprised if it's not 4-0, if not 5-0.
Right, there we go. That's a Glenn McGrath claim if ever I heard one. Okay.
I think I've got quite a lot of factual basis to.
I'm sure McGrath thought that too. Now, just one last thing, very quickly, is that obviously you're very very heavily involved in the kind of world of punditry. I don't know if punditry is the right word, but certainly, you know, in the blogging and podcasting world. Do you have any recommendations of other blogs and podcasts that have caught your eye that people should be watching out for?
For English people, I think you need to follow the Full Toss.
Yeah.
And also the Middle Stump. I think come the Ashes, they'll be fantastic. And I was going to say Dimitri Old, but he's changed his bloody website to something else now.
Okay.
I think those two from an English perspective are must-haves. And there's some other interesting ones around the world. There's little ones that I see now, and then there's... I'd have to get them up on my screen because they're all the Blogspot or WordPress, but they're probably the big two from an English fan's perspective. And I think the Full Toss has really evolved in the last sort of 18 months into a bona fide, serious powerhouse of English cricket. You know, John Etheridge now speaks on there. And the Middle Stump with Dan, they've interviewed Piers Morgan. You know, they're serious sites to get involved with.
A bona fide serious powerhouse of English cricket, and English cricket could really do with some bona fide serious powerhouses at the moment. Dennis Friedman, thank you very much indeed.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And finally, to the last word. Now, this is a new feature on Reverse Swept Radio, where we're planning to take a look ahead at the next few weeks in cricket and trying to make some big, bold and probably wrong predictions. Toby, will Alistair Cook be captain for the start of the New Zealand series?
Yes.
As easy as that?
Oh, sorry, I thought you did just want a one-word answer, but no, if I have to elaborate. I do think that England are not very good at having a plan. And I think in order to get rid of Alistair Cook, I think they'd have to have a plan in place as to what to do next. And the whole process that has been gone through so far feels a little bit as if they are feeling their way forward.
Mm.
And I think they will. I think Alistair Cook will go at some point during this English summer, and unless he starts scoring triple hundreds and England win every match by an innings of 500 runs, Alistair Cook will go. I think otherwise it'll be too much change too soon for a setup that is young and fragile. What would you say, yes or no?
So I would agree with you. He'll certainly be captain at the start of the New Zealand series. I think what's interesting, I think if there was an obvious successor, I think they'd turn to him. I think if Ian Bell looked like he fancied captaincy, I think they would go to him. Because I think there's a sense that actually Cook would quite like to just bat. I know he would probably deny it and probably say...
So you're thinking that they would keep him in the team? I would have thought they would just drop him.
Drop him fully. Oh, that's
because look, it's not just that England aren't winning. It's that he hasn't scored any decent. You know, he scored one century in however long it is.
Well,
a year and a bit in Test cricket.
It's funny though, isn't it? The way we idolise hundreds. That you know, it's odd that one inning suddenly does seem to have changed the narrative around him completely. I mean, while we're thinking England selection, let's imagine Kevin Peterson piles the runs up. I mean, Surrey are in action today. County Championship. Well, let's imagine he makes a real shed load, which, to be fair, he hasn't done as yet in the County Championship. Is there any possibility he puts himself in the squad?
Yes. And I think, actually, this is all part and parcel of the same thing. I think that... Not the reason England have changed their setup, but it would have been impossible for Peterson to come back while it was in the Moors setup and while sort of the old guard was there. But now
new management, they can make their own decisions. Said you know some fairly unpleasant things about Peterson in the past, but you reckon there's a way forward potentially between Strauss and Peterson?
Well, who knows? But I suspect that if Strauss has been put into this job because he's a good diplomat and he's a good leader. And if he is, then he should be able to build bridges with people with whom when he was a captain and even when he was a commentator, he was burning bridges. Would you want to see Peterson back?
Well, this is the old.
We've revisited this
a million and a half times.
Just like you'd like seeing Dwayne Bravo in a sequin dress. you'd like to see Kevin Peterson back in the England side.
I like both of those things roughly the same amount. In that, I think they're both brave things to do, but possibly ill-advised. I've always been of the Peterson is a hero camp, and I think you know it's this old point of select what the opposition doesn't want to see, and I think from an Australia point of view, you do not want to see Kevin Peterson coming down those steps. But I also take the point, I think, that actually that England top order looks pretty settled now. I mean, actually, the openers aside, 3, 4, 5, 6 looks settled to me.
Very settled, doesn't it? Yeah.
No, well, obviously, the openings remain the problem. But, you know, you look at sort of Balance, Root, Bell and co, and you think, actually, unlikely to see that being shifted. So I don't expect to see him back. The final point I think I'd be keen to sort of get some predictions on is the England-New Zealand series itself. Because I think... And this is part of our over-obsession with the Ashes generally as a nation. This keeps being seen in the context of a warm-up for the Ashes. I think there's a fantastic chance New Zealand will turn England over. I think not only are they an incredibly talented side, particularly really well-equipped in the seam bowling department, I think they're a team that mentally are in a fantastic place. You know, you look at them in the World Cup, and I know the differences between ODI and Test, blah, 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 blah. But there's a wonderful unity, purpose, confidence, and fun in the way they play their cricket that couldn't be further from the nervous anxiety that's characterising this England team at present.
Absolutely, and you just hope that for the New Zealanders that the high of the World Cup doesn't then have the kind of low that sometimes inevitably follows such things. I mean, it's astonishing that we're saying as thoroughbred Englishmen, I've never described myself as thoroughbred before, horses are thoroughbred. Anyway... But as Englishmen through and through, that we're hopeful for a strong New Zealand showing. But frankly, I think New Zealand have captured all of our hearts. So anyway, I think that last section has just gone to show that we have no idea what's going to happen over the next few weeks. That was the 69th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon. I think that works really well.